We'll take out your Bibles this evening and turn to the book of Esther. We're going to be concluding our study tonight through the book of Esther. We're grateful for each one here tonight. We have some visitors, and we're grateful that you're here. We hope that we can get to know you better as we visit some maybe after services tonight. I've really enjoyed studying this book with each of you here. Esther is a really remarkable book of the Scriptures. As we've talked about the historical context of Esther, it puts it in a very difficult time period in Israel's history. And again, I've done this introduction each time because I want us to remember the context of Esther, I think, is one of the things that gives the book its emphasis and its power. And as we think about the situation of being separated from your people, from your homeland, for the amount of time that these people were, it's just incredible to see the kind of courage and to see the provision of the Lord, even in the midst of a people who, in some ways, had forgotten His laws, forgotten their roots. And so I just want to encourage us to continue to think about Esther in its context as we study tonight. And as we draw this book to a close, you'll remember a brief overview of the chapters we've studied already. From the beginning, we've seen Ahasuerus acting just not much like a king in this book, kind of letting everybody else run the show. We had his edict over all the land after Vashti's refusal, him finding Esther, and ending up with the Lord's favor, of course, that she ends up becoming queen. And Mordecai just so happens that he hears about this plot against the king and saves his life. Mordecai defies Haman, so Haman, of course, decides not to only eliminate Mordecai, but to eliminate his entire race of people throughout the empire. And that plot to kill all of the Jews is what we're going to be dealing with tonight. You remember back in chapter 3 that when you put that edict into effect, one does not simply turn that around in the kingdom of the Medes and the Persians. In chapter 4, we had the Jews' reaction to that, of Mordecai's mourning and the Jews' mourning, and his Mordecai's really amazing plea to Esther, basically, if you don't do this, the Lord, he doesn't say that, but the word's the Lord, but basically, deliverance will come from somewhere else for your people, but you and your family's house will not be spared. And Esther rises to the challenge, goes before the king, and asks, of all things, for a banquet. And kind of puts this off, and I think heightens the tension, you know, as the king is wondering, what could Esther possibly want to talk about that she would risk her life coming into my presence? And of course, Haman, meanwhile, is cutting that short by planning to hang Mordecai the very next day. And so it's on that night of all nights that the king can't sleep. And through this series of events that just so happens that evening, Haman ends up being the one to honor Mordecai and parade him through the streets, crying out, you know, this is the one that the king wants to honor. And the things that he thought would be done for himself end up being done for Mordecai. And so on the second banquet, Esther reveals that this is indeed Haman, again, leading up without revealing who it is, and then finally showing the king it's this wicked Haman. And Haman, of course, the king is in a tough spot at that moment because he had issued that edict, and he couldn't just kill Haman for doing what the king had essentially said for it to be done. He gave Haman his signet ring. But Haman ends up in that position with Esther, you know, with the couch there, and Haman is easily framed in that position, and so it looks like he's assaulting the queen. So Haman ends up being hung, of course, on his own gallows. I remember my time in college, we had kind of different levels of fail. And there was like regular fail, there was like mega fail, and then there was Haman fail. We kind of use that term of, you know, he ends up being hung on his own gallows. That's just a new level of low. So we're going to pick up our study tonight in Esther chapter 8. And we'll begin reading in verses 1 through 8. And just as we come to this part of the book, sometimes we kind of forget about this. We remember, okay, you know, Esther saves the Jews by being brave and going in front of the king, and then Haman's hung on his own gallows and they all lived happily ever after. Well, there's more to the story. The plot line is not done because Haman's plot to kill the Jews is still in effect. And so they're going to have to deal with this edict that's been passed, and we'll see what happens here in chapter 8. Chapter 8, beginning in verse 1. On that day, King Ahasuerus gave to Queen Esther the house of Haman, the enemy of the Jews. And Mordecai came before the king, for Esther had told what he was to her. And the king took off his signet ring, which he had taken from Haman, and gave it to Mordecai. And Esther set Mordecai over the house of Haman. Then Esther spoke again to the king. She fell at his feet and wept and pleaded with him to avert the evil plan of Haman the Agagite and the plot that he had devised against the Jews. When the king held out the golden scepter to Esther, Esther rose and stood before the king. And she said, "If it please the king, and if I have found favor in his sight, and if the thing seems right before the king, and I am pleasing in his eyes, let an order be written to revoke the letters devised by Haman the Agagite, the son of Hammedatha, which he wrote to destroy the Jews who are in all the provinces of the king. For how can I bear to see the calamity that is coming on my people? Or how can I bear to see the destruction of my kindred?" The king Ahasuerus said to Queen Esther and to Mordecai the Jew, "Behold, I have given Esther the house of Haman, and they have hanged him on the gallows, because he intended to lay hands on the Jews. But you may write as you please with regard to the Jews, in the name of the king, and seal it with the king's ring. For an edict written in the name of the king and sealed with the king's ring cannot be revoked." So we have here kind of the aftermath of Haman's death. Of course, he's hanged on his own gallows at the end of chapter 7. And the king ends up giving everything that belonged to Haman to Esther, who in turn puts it into the care of Mordecai. So again, just to add insult to injury, kind of in the wake of Haman's death, now everything that was Haman belongs to these Jews that he was trying to kill. And interestingly enough, specifically, it says that the king gave his signet ring, who apparently Mordecai was kind of still wearing around. It's still amazing to me that Ahasuerus would kind of take his symbol of utmost authority and just kind of pass it around. And I'm like, oh, hey, you know, here, you can now use the signet ring. But he gives the signet ring to Mordecai in this case, which will become significant in just a moment. Mordecai is now in Haman's place, and you remember this is similar to the transfer of power you had when Esther took Queen Vashti's place back in chapter 2, that the king, when his wrath abates, he is now looking for someone to fill this position, and now Mordecai occupies the very place that Haman occupied in his power and his position. And so we have this plea to the king that Esther has, and she's asking if this letter that was signed with the king's signet ring could be revoked. You know, okay, you know, my people are saved for a moment here, but this date in the 12th month is still on its way, and my people are going to be killed. You know, that hasn't been revoked. Can you undo the letter? And essentially what the king is going to say is, well, no, I can't, because once it's signed with the king's signet ring, it cannot be revoked. And the king doesn't really have another plan for her, as usual. It just seems like the king just has no real ideas of his own. He knows what the law says. But he does, in this case, say, you've got the signet ring. Do whatever you want to do. You know, you pass a law, it's like I'm passing the law for you. And he doesn't really give them any limitations on that. Gives them unlimited authority for them to try to fix this situation. So there's this real question, okay, what are you going to do? You've got this edict that's been passed, and all the enemies of the Jews throughout the whole kingdom of Persia are going to, on the 13th day of the 12th month, try to annihilate the Jews. So what plan are you going to come up with to defend yourselves now that this edict cannot be revoked? So let's read verses 9 through 17. The king's scribes were summoned at that time in the third month, which is the month of Sivan, on the 23rd day, and an edict was written according to all that Mordecai commanded concerning the Jews to the satraps and the governors and the officials of the provinces from India to Ethiopia, 127 provinces, to each province in its own script and to each people in its own language, and also to the Jews in their script and their language. And he wrote in the name of King Ahasuerus and sealed it with the king's signet ring. Then he sent the letters by mounted couriers riding on swift horses that were used in the king's service, bred from the royal stud, saying that the king allowed the Jews who were in every city to gather and defend their lives, to destroy, to kill, and to annihilate any armed force of any people or province that might attack them, children and women included, and to plunder their goods. On one day throughout all the provinces of King Ahasuerus, on the 13th day of the 12th month, which is the month of Adar, a copy of what was written was to be issued as a decree in every province, being publicly displayed to all peoples. And the Jews were to be ready on that day to take vengeance on their enemies. So the couriers mounted on their swift horses that were used in the king's service, rode out hurriedly, urged by the king's command, and the decree was issued in Susa, the citadel. Then Mordecai went out from the presence of the king in royal robes of blue and white, with a great golden crown and a robe of fine linen and purple. And the city of Susa shouted and rejoiced. The Jews had light and gladness and joy and honor. And in every province and in every city, wherever the king's command and his edict reached, there was gladness and joy among the Jews, a feast and a holiday, and many from the peoples of the country declared themselves Jews, for the fear of the Jews had fallen on them. So we're dealing with the situation in the third month, in the 23rd day. You remember the edict when Haman was casting lots, or casting Pur, or Purim, that's going to become significant in a little bit, that the lot had fallen on that 12th month, which again, I just think we see the Lord's hand in all of this, that all of the events up to this point, it's a little bit surprising, this seems to have transpired in just a couple of months' time. We were in the first month earlier in the story, and by this point, we're in the third month. So the Jews are going to have some time to prepare and defend themselves. So the plot that they come up with is that the Jews will be allowed to defend themselves by force. And that if anyone is planning to attack them, or their women or their children, then they're allowed to gather and to defend their lives, apparently without persecution of the law. Because you've got this situation which is essentially going to be somewhat of a civil war. You know, the Jews have been taken into the kingdom of Persia, and now you're going to have them maybe going to be annihilated, but now they're allowed to fight back and kill the Persians, kill whoever it is that is going to be against them. And what's going to be interesting in this is it seems to be, at least to me, primarily an act of self-defense that they're putting into motion. It does say in verse 13 to be ready on that day to take vengeance on their enemies. So there's two kind of very different ways to look at what's about to happen. And one kind of paints the Jews in a very malicious and vicious light, as you're thinking, all right, they've been trying to oppress us, so we're just going to go on a killing spree, basically. And, you know, we get to go and kill as many of the Persians in one day as we want to. I don't think that's the picture here. It is true that these people have been their enemies, and there are still people who are going to take advantage of Haman's edict and attack the Jews. But the Jews are allowed to defend themselves, and in so doing, take vengeance upon their enemies. So I think it's really important that we distinguish that. Critics of the book of Esther want to kind of paint this situation in a very different light to make the Jews look kind of bloodthirsty, and later on when Esther asks for an extra day, like, let's just keep on killing, you know. I don't think that's what we see here. Even though that word vengeance is used here, I don't think that's the motivation behind what the Jews are doing. So I just want to make that distinction. What's interesting here is after this decree, of course, the repetition in this section reminds us of the edict that was sent out when Haman's decree went forth. So all the provinces, each in their own language and all these different things. And so, of course, as far as the edict went that said you can kill the Jews, the edict needs to go to the same people to say, well, the Jews can now defend themselves. And this section at the end of chapter 8 is so parallel to what we read back in chapter 4. After the king's edict went out that the Jews were going to be executed, you remember when Mordecai heard about that, he tore his clothes, put on sackcloth and ashes, went out into the midst of the city, cried out with that loud and bitter cry, and in every province, wherever the king's command and decree reached, there was great mourning among the Jews with fasting and weeping and lamenting, and many of them lay in sackcloth and ashes. Now it's almost the exact opposite. You've got Mordecai going out from the presence of the king, or at least after having signed this letter with the king's signet ring in robes of blue and white with this great golden crown and a robe of fine linen and purple, and the city of Susa shouted and rejoiced. And the Jews had gladness and joy of heart, and wherever this same edict goes, there's just this rejoicing throughout the land of Persia. And you think about, for the Jews who had not heard maybe about all that has gone on, you know, they just like, you think about the Jews even living back in Judah and you know, during that time, during the days of Ezra, that you've got Jews who may not have heard anything else except, we're going to be killed in a few months. And now here comes another edict from the king a couple of months later saying, okay, you can defend yourselves. You can gather together. You're not just going to be annihilated with no one to defend you. You now have legal protection to fight back and to preserve your lives. So this is an incredible turning of that mourning into joy. And we see that theme throughout the scriptures, and it's just so clear here after that statement in chapter 4, and now this statement in chapter 8, of the same people who are mourning are now rejoicing and giving thanks. And interestingly enough, at the end of chapter 8, what do we see many of the Persians even doing there? They become Jews or declare themselves Jews, that now the once oppressed people who are going to be killed in all the nation, it's popular to be a Jew now. You know, the public opinion has been swayed in the complete opposite direction now, and people are declaring themselves Jews, for the fear of the Jews had fallen on them. We'll talk more about that in just a moment. So we come to the last couple of chapters, Esther chapter 9. We'll read verses 1 through 19. Now in the 12th month, which is the month of Adar, on the 13th day of the same, when the king's command and edict were about to be carried out on the very day when the enemies of the Jews hoped to gain the mastery over them, the reverse occurred. The Jews gained mastery over those who hated them. The Jews gathered in their cities throughout all the provinces of King Ahasuerus to lay hands on those who sought their harm, and no one could stand against them, for the fear of them had fallen on all peoples. All the officials of the provinces and the satraps and the governors and the royal agents also helped the Jews, for the fear of Mordecai had fallen on them. For Mordecai was great in the king's house, and his fame spread throughout all the provinces. For the man Mordecai grew more and more powerful. The Jews struck all their enemies with the sword, killing and destroying them, and did as they pleased to their enemies, or did as they pleased to those who hated them. In Susa, the citadel itself, the Jews killed and destroyed 500 men. And he killed also, pardon me on these names, Parshandatha, and Dalphon, and Hasphatha, and Parhatha, and Adala, and Adriatha, and Parmashta, and Arasai, and Adriai, and Vazthatha, the 10 sons of Haman, the sons of Hamadatha, the enemy of the Jews. But they laid no hand on the plunder. That very day, the number of those killed in Susa, the citadel, was reported to the king. And the king said to Queen Esther, in Susa, the citadel, the Jews have killed and destroyed 500 men, and also the 10 sons of Haman. What then have they done in the rest of the king's provinces? Now, what is your wish? It shall be granted you. And what further is your request? It shall be fulfilled. And Esther said, if it please the king, let the Jews who are in Susa be allowed tomorrow also to do according to this day's edict. And let the 10 sons of Haman be hanged on the gallows. So the king commanded this to be done. A decree was issued in Susa, and the 10 sons of Haman were hanged. The Jews who were in Susa gathered also on the 14th day of the month of Adar, and they killed 300 men in Susa. But they laid no hands on the plunder. Now the rest of the Jews who were in the king's provinces also gathered to defend their lives, and got relief from their enemies, and killed 75,000 of those who hated them. But they laid no hands on the plunder. This was on the 13th day of the month of Adar, and on the 14th day they rested, and made that day a day of feasting and gladness. But the Jews who were in Susa gathered on the 13th day and on the 14th, and rested on the 15th day, making that day a day of feasting and gladness. Therefore the Jews of the villages who live in the rural towns hold the 14th day of the month of Adar as a day for gladness and feasting, as a holiday, and as a day on which they send gifts of food to one another. So here we have what was going to be the slaughter and annihilation of the Jews turned on its head. And now we have the Lord giving this nation that is captive in a foreign country victory over those who hate them. And apparently there were a lot of people who hated the Jews. So thousands and thousands of them who come against the Jews on this day to destroy them. And you just think about this. It reminds me of when the children of Israel came out of the nation of Egypt. You've got essentially a nation of slaves. People who here, who for a generation or more, at least about 70 years at this point, have been in a foreign nation serving the Persians. They're not trained in war. They're not prepared to deal with battle. And I don't know all the different types of people who are coming against them. But it doesn't seem like the Israelites should prevail like they do on this day. Except, of course, that the Lord is with his people. And just like when the children of Israel went into the land of Canaan against people greater and mightier than they were and shouldn't have won any of those battles, starting with Jericho, the Lord fights for his people and gives them the victory on this day and the next day as well in the capital. And it's interesting that the fear of the Jews falls on their enemies. And that reminds us of the statement. You remember Rahab said, when the children of Israel were coming into the land of Canaan, it says, "The fear of you has fallen on all the inhabitants of the land, and their hearts melt within them." Just like God said they would in Exodus 15 in the Song of Moses, and says, the hearts of the Canaanites melt within them. The same thing happens to those who hate the Jews here hundreds of years later, even as they're captive in another nation. So I just think we see parallels between the Exodus and God's liberating his people from slavery then and bringing them into the promised land, and these people who are captive in Persia, and the Lord taking care of them and providing for them in the same way. It's interesting as well that Mordecai, because of his greatness and his now political power, that throughout the whole kingdom of Persia, you've got some of the officials, the satraps and the governors, helping the Jews. And I don't know if they're able to send military help to them or monetary help or just arrange things for them in each city to where it's favorable conditions for the Jews to defend themselves. But whatever it was, it's interesting that the fear of Mordecai had fallen on them, that because of his strength, they are now, maybe for political favor with him or whatever it was, they are now helping the Jews instead of maybe even in some cases defending their own people. We have Haman's 10 sons who are killed, and then later they're going to be hanged. I think we see two separate events happening here, that they're killed in Susa, the capital. So the judgment on the house of Haman now also falls on his sons, which is kind of interesting. You remember, going all the way back, Mordecai is a descendant of who? Of Kish. He's a Benjamite, so he's of the house of Saul. And Haman is a descendant of who? Of Agag, the Amalekites. And you remember what they were told to do, that Saul was to go and utterly destroy the Amalekites. And so in some ways, I think you have some of the carrying out of what Saul failed to do here. Haman's been killed, and now they eliminate his descendants as well. And I think the idea is when they hang them, it's like they've already been killed, but now they're being put up for public display. They just take the dead bodies and hang them so that everyone can see this great victory. And again, the opposite, they follow in the steps of their father in that sense. The opposite of what he was going to do with Mordecai. And so the king, even after this great slaughter, and there's 500 killed in the capital on that day, so who knows how many more in the other provinces, he still comes back to Esther. Anything else you want? You know, I just think it's kind of amazing, the king just still wanting to do things for people. And so she asks for two things. She asks for one more day that the Jews can defend themselves on the next day. And I'm not sure all of the reasons for her asking that. It may be that because maybe this didn't go the way that everyone who hated the Jews was planning for it to go, that now that they've suffered a great loss, that they're going to come back the next day and take vengeance on the Jews. I'm not sure what she has in mind. But specifically in the capital, she asks for one more day of legal protection, basically, so the Jews can defend themselves. And they do end up killing some more of their enemies on that day. It doesn't appear that happened in all the other places. The kind of the hatred against the Jews was concentrated in Susa, the capital, and that's where some more fighting goes on. So the day after that, on the 14th day, all the rest of the kingdom is resting, and there's one more day of fighting in the capital, and then on the 15th day, the capital rests as well after winning more of a victory. What's also interesting is in each of those cases, they refuse the plunder. And you remember back in chapter 8 is what they could do in verse 11. They could attack these, kill and annihilate, and they could plunder their goods. It was specifically mentioned by Mordecai in the king's edict that you can take the goods from them. So why didn't they? I think it's an interesting question. That it says three times, verse 10, verse 15, verse 16, that they refused to take the plunder from their enemies. I think there are maybe a couple of reasons for that. One is that you remember that just as maybe in the killing of Haman's sons, you have the fulfilling of what the Lord told Saul to do in annihilating the Amalekites. You remember what else the Lord said to Saul when he was going to annihilate the Amalekites is you take all of their possessions as well and utterly destroy everything. In other words, no plunder. Totally annihilate the Amalekites and everything that belongs to them. And so it may well be that they remember what was supposed to be done from those times all the way back when the Lord gave that command in 1 Samuel 15:3, and that they say, we're not going to take the plunder. That's not what was supposed to happen when we took vengeance then, and it's not what's going to happen when we take vengeance now, even though we have the right legally to do that. Another reason may well be that similar to when the children of Israel came into the land of Canaan and came to Jericho. And you remember that was also the rule at Jericho. No plunder. Because this belongs to the Lord. We say, you know, to the victor go the spoils, right? It may have also been the idea that the children of Israel wanted to honor the Lord because they realized that this victory was not theirs. That they shouldn't have won this great battle that was happening all over the place. And that they are devoting the spoils to the Lord because it is the Lord who is the victor on this day. So some possibilities there that I think may be likely as to why they refuse the plunder. But either way, I think we see them acting nobly in refusing the plunder. I think we see their motives in that. The people who want to make this part of the book look all bloodthirsty, and, oh, they're asking for another day of killing and all this, then they refuse the plunder. I mean, I just don't think if they were really, if their purpose was vengeance, they would have taken the plunder. You know, if that's what they wanted to do, they had the right to do it. But I think we see the heart of the Jews and their attitude in this is not just one of let's just get back at them, but let's defend ourselves, let's defend our people, and honor the Lord in the process. I believe that's what we're seeing here in this section. So let's read verses 20 through 32. And Mordecai reported these things and sent letters to all the Jews who were in all the provinces of King Ahasuerus, both near and far, obliging them to keep the 14th day of the month Adar, and also the 15th day of the same, year by year, as the days on which the Jews got relief from their enemies, and as the month that had been for them from sorrow into gladness, and from mourning into a holiday, that they should make them days of feasting and gladness, days for sending gifts of food to one another, and gifts to the poor. So the Jews accepted what they had started to do and what Mordecai had written to them. For Haman the Agagite, the son of Hammedatha, the enemy of all the Jews, had plotted against the Jews to destroy them, and had cast her, that is, lots, to crush and destroy them. When it came before the king, he gave orders in writing that his evil plot that he had devised against the Jews should return on his own head, that he and his son should be hanged on the gallows. Therefore they called these days Purim, after the term Pur. Therefore, because of all that was written in this letter, and of what they had faced in this manner, and of what had happened to them, the Jews firmly obligated themselves and their offspring and all who joined them, that without fail they would keep these 2 days according to what was written and at the time appointed every year, that these days should be remembered and kept throughout every generation, in every clan, province, and city, and that these days of Purim should never fall into disuse among the Jews, nor should the commemoration of these days cease among their descendants. Then Queen Esther, the daughter of Abihail, and Mordecai the Jew, gave full written authority, confirming the second letter about Purim. Letters were sent to all the Jews, to the 127 provinces of the kingdom of Ahasuerus, in words of peace and truth, that these days of Purim should be observed at their appointed seasons, as Mordecai the Jew and Queen Esther obligated them, and as they had obligated themselves and their offspring, with regard to their fasts and their lamenting. The command of Queen Esther confirmed these practices of Purim, and it was recorded in writing. So we have this lengthy section at the end of chapter 9 talking about, really, maybe one of the purposes of the book of Esther was to tell you, well, why are we doing this Feast of Purim? And my understanding is in Jewish tradition, there's a setup where they read this story of Esther at the Feast of Purim, and the kids all have like these little noisemakers and things, and so whenever Haman's name comes up, they make the noises and like drown out the name of Haman and things like that. There's different traditions that are connected to the reading of Esther in this Jewish feast. But here we have the same method employed to send out the edict about Purim that was used to send out the edict about the destruction of the Jews and the defense of the Jews. And so Esther and Mordecai lead their people in commemorating this day. And while this was not a feast that was commanded by the Lord and given as a holy feast, part of the law of Moses or anything like that, it does remind us of like the Feast of Passover and the feast that were commemorated, remembering the deliverance that the Lord gave, and that their descendants should not forget about that. You remember that the Passover was to be something such that when their children asked, you know, what is it that you're doing here? That they would say, well, let me tell you about what the Lord did for us when he brought us out of the land of Egypt and when he did these great signs and led us through the Red Sea. And it was an opportunity for parents to teach their children. And in the same way, even though still the Lord's name is never mentioned, I think what we see here is an opportunity for the next generation and the next generation to be told about the great acts of the Lord and to be led to further faith in him by what they heard about his deliverance. It's interesting that, to my knowledge, there's not another mention of this feast being kept. There's some debate among scholars that in the Gospel of John, chapter 5, the unnamed feast there might be the Feast of Purim. It's hard to tell exactly in that text. So just as a reference, if there's questions about, well, does Purim come up other places? It might be in John, chapter 5, but we're not sure. So let's finish our reading in chapter 10, verses 1 through 3, one of the shortest chapters in the Old Testament here. King Ahasuerus imposed tax on the land and on the coastlands of the sea, and all the acts of his power and might, and the full account of the high honor of Mordecai, to which the king advanced him, are they not written in the book of the Chronicles of the kings of Media and Persia? For Mordecai the Jew was second in rank to King Ahasuerus, and he was great among the Jews, and popular with the multitude of his brothers. For he sought the welfare of his people and spoke peace to all his people. So at the end of the book of Esther, we have the power of Mordecai, around whom a lot of this story has kind of revolved, being raised up in position to second in command in all the land of Persia. Does that remind us of anybody that the Lord has worked with before? In just the kingdom before this, we remember Daniel. In the Babylonian kingdom, and then in the early days of the kingdom of Persia, had held that second in command or third in command, depending on when he was. And it also reminds us of Joseph, when the Lord raises up Joseph to be second in command of Pharaoh and help the deliverance of his people during that famine. So it's just amazing for us to see that the Lord takes care of his people over and over again. When they're enslaved in foreign nations, God can raise up people who are willing to serve him and do whatever he wants in the kingdoms of men and give it to whoever he wills. A couple of lessons as we draw our observations to a close this evening. And that is that even though, we've mentioned this from the beginning of our study, even though the name of God is not mentioned anywhere in the book of Esther, God is on every page of this book. Over and over and over. All the coincidences that lead up to each event, I don't think it would be possible without the intervention and guiding hand of the Lord. And I think that's encouraging for us because we don't see God's hand in some physical way in our lives. And sometimes it's easy for us to doubt that the Lord is still working in his providence and still working in his ways. We don't see God's name written on the things in our life. It's a little easier sometimes to look back and speculate more specifically, like, I really think the Lord did this or that. But we don't always know. Perhaps he did it, perhaps he didn't. But whatever the case, we know that the Lord is working. And we know that the Lord takes care of his people wherever they are. However far away they might feel from their strength and protection, however distant they may feel from their kinsmen, God is with us if we're with him. And with whatever the future of this nation may be, I know sometimes in my mind as I think about the implications of what's happening around us, it's really discouraging sometimes to try to think about what this generation and the next generation are going to face. But I don't know if it's any more dire than what these people are facing here. You know, I mean, you've got a situation that's incredibly bad, that it looks like there's no way out. But the book of Esther should remind us with certainty that whatever happens in this country or any other country, the Lord is with his people. And we need to be like Daniel and his friends. You know, the Lord might deliver us like he did the Jews, but even if he doesn't, we're going to do what's right, whatever happens. And that's easy to say in times of peace. But the book of Esther helps us see that even in those times of crisis, those who are courageous, those who will do what the Lord wants them to do, can be rescued. And the Lord will take care of them in whatever way is best. We're reminded of Haman, I think, even in the hanging of Haman's sons, of just the consequences of sin and hatred through the book of Esther, that your sin will return on your own head. How many times does it say that in the law, and talking about the reversal of those things, the blessings and the curses of the law? And isn't that exactly what happened to Haman there, as he said in chapter 9? He returned these things on his own head. And we need to be reminded and warned that even if it doesn't look like, in the same way that we don't see God working positively, sometimes we don't immediately see the negative things happening with our sin. And we need to take warning and think about, even if we don't see it now, the recompense for our sin is coming, and the Lord will be active in that if we do not repent. And it also affects other people. You think about Haman's family and those with him that ended up being killed because of all of this. We need to remember sin and its consequences. But I want to end on this point tonight, that in God, our mourning is turned into gladness. And that's how the book of Esther ends, is throughout the whole book, there's just been this mourning, this weeping and wailing, that we have no hope, there's no escape for us. And God takes that mourning and that impossible situation and turns it into a feast to be remembered through all generations. And that is exactly what the Lord has done in Jesus Christ, isn't it? In the passage that Jesus read about himself on that day in the synagogue when he opened the scroll of Isaiah, he read from Isaiah 61. And in this very context, I think it's interesting to see this kind of language used about what the Messiah would come to do. The Spirit of the Lord God is upon me because the Lord has anointed me to bring good news to the poor. And he has sent me to bind up the brokenhearted, to proclaim liberty to the captives, and the opening of the prison to those who are bound, to proclaim the year of the Lord's favor and the day of the vengeance of our God, to comfort all who mourn, to grant to those who mourn in Zion, to give them a beautiful headdress instead of ashes, the oil of gladness instead of mourning, the garment of praise instead of a faint spirit, that they may be called oaks of righteousness, the planting of the Lord, that he may be glorified. And really, isn't that the invitation that's offered in all of this? Is that if you're here tonight and you realize the sin in your life, and you realize the impossible slavery that you're in, and you are moved to mourn because of that, the Lord can turn that mourning into gladness tonight. The Lord can turn that slavery into freedom. That's what Jesus said, isn't it? Blessed are those who mourn, for they shall be comforted. If you're here tonight and you need to put on the Lord Jesus Christ, and you need to make him the Lord of your life, realizing the sins that you've done, mourning for them, and repenting of those sins, you can do that tonight. You can be baptized to walk in newness of life and walk in a brand new life that God will give you. And if you're here tonight and you realize that you've gone away from the Lord, and you need to come back to him in some way and be right with your God who can deliver you, won't you come while we stand and sing this song?